Hi, my name is Anthea Williams and welcome to Activated Arts on 2RPH. Today I'm joined by Kylie Maslin and Jacinta Parsons, ahead of their session at the Sydney Writers' Festival on Writing the Invisible on the 2nd of May. We're discussing their new books and all things chronic illness. Kylie is a writer, critic and author of Show Me Where It Hurts, Living with Invisible Illness. Her work has appeared in The Guardian, Minjin, Kill Your Darlings, Adelaide Review, Crikey and Junkie, among others. She lives in Adelaide on Kuna country. Jacinta Parsons is a radio broadcaster and writer from Melbourne, Australia, who has worked at both community radio station Triple R and for both Double J and ABC Radio Melbourne. Her first book is Unseen, The Secret World of Chronic Illness. It explores her experiences with Crohn's disease and how chronic illness has shaped her life. Jacinta and Kylie, thank you so much for joining me today.
Such a pleasure. Very, very happy to be here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I think I should just say this up front, and I might edit this bit out, but this is my 8th ever radio show, and Jacinta, you're one of Australia's most loved radio hosts. So I'm both thrilled and terrified to have you on the show. I thought it was just best to get that out there at the beginning so we could focus on the thrilled bit and I could acknowledge I'm very new at this. If you have any notes for me at the end, I'm going to be really happy to hear them.
I've made a career in radio by making pretty much a brand of mistakes. That's what I am, is a very, very dodgy radio presenter. So I will have no notes for you, but I'm so happy to be here.
Look, I think that humanity is what people love, and I think that's what I really felt about your book as well. So, Kylie, just like your book, I think it's really important that you start off telling us about the importance of SpongeBob SquarePants.
He is a beautiful sea sponge who lives under the sea in Bikini Village, I think it's called, Bikini Bottom. I've always been a big watcher of cartoons and I find them really comforting now when my mental health is not in a good place in particular, or if I'm having a pain episode, and it makes for very relatable material when you are in a tough place with invisible illness, I think, because he is so expressive and it's identifiable. I have really found in the last few years in particular that memes have really helped me express what I'm going through, because I found writing about my mental illnesses and about my chronic pain quite difficult. I kind of lose my ability with words often. But having this kind of image of him doing something quirky with a little caption around it is very easy for me to kind of send to friends and family and be like, this is how I'm feeling today.
Yeah, I love that. I think it's also beautiful the way that acknowledges how the English language can be very limited in terms of how you express yourself. I felt so seen when I read your book, Kylie. But it articulated for me not just personal experience, but also how we live our life in relation to arts and the media. And, you know, for anyone who hasn't read the book yet, which I assume a lot of our listeners won't, I think there's this amazing journey that you take through it, where you start and you're getting fragments of media and you're hearing about the treatment of women like Taylor Swift and Beyonce and then Frida Kahlo. It's a great frame for how women in general are viewed by culture. Did that frame of art and popular culture come to you at the beginning, or was that something you found as you were writing the book?
Actually, you just saying that has made me see that almost all of the pop culture references are of women. There are a few of men, SpongeBob himself included. In terms of like the framing of the chapters having the cultural criticism against the kind of lived experience of illness, that came quite early, like the first chapter with SpongeBob as a way of talking about pain and giving language to pain. That was the first chapter I wrote. I had a couple of intentions for it, and that was that it made it an accessible way for people who perhaps don't have illness to come into the book. I really wanted to not only have people who are also going through similar situations to feel seen, like you said, which is very flattering, thank you, but to be able to share this with their friends and family and colleagues, and for them to be more understood by the people in their lives, and just to be able to open those conversations.
Jacinta, in Unseen, you chronicle some of your very first experiences with the medical system. At six, I think one of the moments I found most devastating in the book is when you're talking about being a six-year-old and being aware that your family GP doesn't trust your mother's version of events when your mother knows that something is wrong. I felt like I wanted to make your book compulsory reading for everyone studying medicine. But I guess my question is, how long was it before you felt like a doctor was truly seeing you? And when did you realise that that was important?
That's a great bit of the book that you've picked out, because no one has talked about that bit. But I think it's a really important signpost for how long we have been going through this experience. I think it's such an interesting question too, because I think I'm still evolving in my understanding that I have a valuable perspective. It's been so ingrained and so constructed in me, and it's so about survival that you are in a good relationship with your medical professional, who's an authority in your space, that I am delicate with it. I was really very conscious that people that I wrote about in that book in challenging ways would read it, and I'm still really, you know, kind of affected by that. So I think, you know, it took a really long time to be seen, and it's an oscillating experience. I've got a great gastroenterologist at the moment that I feel really seen by, but I went and saw a GP the other day, and I was right back at square one, you know, where you sort of go, oh, gosh, okay. You know, your credentials haven't been recognised by this doctor in terms of your experience in the medical system, and it's very easy to undermine your own confidence in what you're saying.
Yeah, I'm quite lucky in that my father is a doctor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and my parents were very much advocates for me, because I have had chronic illness since I was two. So they, my journey and all of my diagnosis was something they dealt with. I didn't really deal with that at all, or not that I remember. But it scares me how many times I've had to say to people talking to me about chronic illness, just lie when you first go into your doctor's office and say that you have a parent who's a doctor, because you will see them assume that your IQ is suddenly 20 points higher.
Yeah. I think I went like that in a reaction, because I sort of feel like you've got to tell people when they're advocating for themselves to really present a really strong picture of the experience. And similarly to you saying that, obviously going in and saying, hey, I've got some credentials here, you know, don't mess around with me. It's a phenomenal way to think about it, isn't it?
Well, it's tragic that you're talking about credentials at this point, but that is absolutely correct. And one thing I was so aware of when I was reading your book, and again, you know, it's that thing of I felt so seen when I read it. You talked so much about always presenting yourself as a good patient. And I absolutely do that. And it was so wonderful, but tragic, to read another woman writing about the effort that you go to make sure that you're seen as a good and intelligent and hardworking patient in order to get the best care.
It's so gendered, isn't it? And I think it's an extension of how we've been constructed to behave as women broadly. But when we enter a medical scenario and a system, the survival that's, you know, that you're very, very aware of is required, well, is hanging on the likelihood of being liked. And there's a truth to that. And being liked as a woman is very different to being liked as a man. And the way that you must behave and code is built into us, but it's absolutely a reality.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm aware that for both of you, we're talking about your first books. And I know a couple of years ago I wrote my first article for The Guardian where I came out publicly as someone with a disability. And I was terrified. Mm. How was the process of writing these books for you? Did it feel like a coming out of sorts? Kylie, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I wrote a piece for Kill Your Darlings back in 2017. That was an essay kind of loosely critiquing Jenny Valentich's book, Woman of Substances. There was so much in there that I saw of my own journey, sorry to abuse that word. That piece really felt like a coming out of that. I, at that point in particular, had really been like self-medicating with drugs and alcohol in order to get any kind of pain relief because doctors were constantly kind of either fobbing me off or just giving me the pain relief but not actually dealing with the pain itself. So that was my main, that was the point where I was a bit terrified. And that piece became kind of reworked to become a chapter in the book, which, yeah, when I gave the book to my family, I was like, the first three chapters are going to be real tough. but you know, if you can get through that, you'll be fine with the rest. Because the other chapter, so there's like the SpongeBob chapter of not being able to talk about pain. There's a chapter about dating while ill, and there's the self-medication stuff. So it's all very personal. And I mean, the book is personal the whole way through, but that those three chapters in particular was what I was, they were the ones in front of mind of these are the chapters that people are going to have opinions on, really. And thankfully, everyone's been pretty great, or at least I've been shielded from the kind of opinions that I was worried about. And I would, yeah, I was kind of worried about sex shaming or questioning choices around substance abuse, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but you've got to live in the world, right? That's what's so great about your book. You present a whole woman who's trying to have the full experiences of life. And I just love that moment where you talk about a medical event that happens after an encounter with a guy who you met on Tinder. And you talk about how this one flaky guy ended up costing you hundreds of dollars and so much medical intervention, and he doesn't even know. And I thought, oh, yeah, that hurts so much. I so get it. And I think it's really important that the breadth of that experience is in that book. How about you, Jacinta? Did it feel scary publishing the book? You do talk a little bit in your book about the first time you talked about living with chronic illness online, but how was it publishing this book?
Well, it's interesting how Kylie has also described the process of it, because that first interview I ever did on radio was, you know, at my radio station about my illness, and I talked about body change and a colostomy bag and the experience that I had with that. And I woke up in a sweat. I thought, oh my God, my workmates will think I'm disgusting. You know, like what horrible ableist concepts that we have internalized. And so what that actually, you know, on further kind of rumination, then I wrote an article as well for, I think, The Age on shame. And that was really the very first kind of way that I approached this book was around that. So the process of exposing yourself is really frightening, but also that you don't, I was really frightened about ever seeming to speak for anyone else. You know, you just really don't ever want to misspeak or do anything that could be harmful to the disability community. So I was really mindful about that and very anxious that it wasn't, you know, that it was true in some way, that it could sit by itself. So those sorts of things, it's such a vulnerable thing to, you know, take off all your clothes and ask people what they think. But we've done that so often, literally, that, you know, in the medical situations, that I think in some way there's a bit of preparation for it.
I also just thought going in that not speaking about things had just got us to this point that we are now. In terms of activism, I'm limited by what I can do because of my disability, but I know I can write about this. So I was really motivated to do it for that reason. let's get it out in the world and let people know what this is really like, even if it does take, you know, a big personal account in order to do that. I think these are the conversations that we need to be having.
Yeah, I completely agree. Jacinta, in your book at some point you talk about this kind of toxic loop that we get ourselves into where we want to be seen, so we get the support and the care and the understanding that we need, but we also don't want to be seen so that we don't miss out on opportunities that people who are perceived as disabled miss out on.
That's right. And the limited way that we understand disability, you know, it's languaged. And so by that very act, you're reductive in the truth of the experience. And that's why, Kylie, your book is just so wonderful in that you really put yourself there for that exploration to be had, you know, where we're seeing the full story. You know, it's not just a thing. It's a thing with the human, with the complexity. And so being seen is great and necessary, but also frightening because you are giving your power outside of you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think one of the most devastating parts of your book, Kylie, that I found was the chapter where you talk about Frida Kahlo. You talk about this moment where Theresa May is wearing a Frida Kahlo bracelet. It's so devastating because her politics were so clear. And you talk about how either her pain is fetishized or completely null and void because, of course, all of those images of Fred that we see again and again and again, reproduced often in an almost kind of pop Andy Warhol style, have their backgrounds taken away. And we see this beautiful woman with flowers in her hair. But actually her work was complex and it was about politics and mechanization and pain. And I guess this is a long way of me getting to the point of why do you think disability representation matters? Which is a massive question, and I apologise, but I think it's really important to ask both of you brilliant women that question.
Yeah, so Theresa May was Prime Minister of Britain and brought in all of these austerity measures, and included in that had cut the heck out of the NHS and the kind of systems that disabled people need that Frida Kahlo as a person would have needed. When she's delivering this speech, she's wearing a bracelet made out of these sort of little squares of different faces of Frida Kahlo's from her own works. And they're all, in the way that I talk about Kahlo's work in the book, they're often, when we look at them today, they're often kind of really filtered as if it's on Snapchat or Instagram, where the things that really draw me to her are not there. You know, like we know that she had really full eyebrows, for example, and those often go in those sorts of pictures. We know that she had hair on her top lip, that's often gone. And definitely her skin is lightened, you know, just all sorts of problematic decisions are made about her appearance. I had been a few years ago, maybe 5-8 years ago, there was an exhibition of her and her husband's work at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. And going through this exhibition was really emotional for me, particularly seeing a work of hers called The Miscarriage Sketch, where I have a postcard of it right by my desk, so I'm looking at it now, where it's a picture of her naked body, but there's like key kind of organs coming out onto the side. And down on the bottom, there's a fetus who hasn't made it. And that picture really hit me, and it really, for the first time, felt like I could see what my body looked like on the inside, that all of these things were operating on their own rather than in harmony. It really started getting me thinking about how serious my own health was. I think I had just kind of been kind of plodding along, thinking, you know, this is ongoing and annoying and bad, but it's, you know, things could always be worse, you know. And seeing this work and then kind of reading a bit more about her, and that kind of opened me up to other disabled activists and artists, and really got me to a point of thinking, I actually am disabled, like things are actually bad enough. And it took me a while to reconcile that. But once I did, I now find it kind of quite empowering in a way that it makes me recognize that things are as bad, and it's not just me. Like, I'm not doing this to myself, or I'm not lazy, or like, you know, all the things that chronically ill or disabled people get told. Her work was really a huge turning point for me, kind of seeing it in the light that it was actually created, rather than those kind of whitewashed pictures that we had seen, like Theresa May had been wearing. So I wanted other people to kind of see that as well, and to be able to have that experience. And that was, I knew that using her would again be quite an accessible way of talking about these things. But it was, again, that's part of the going back to using media as a visual to kind of break open these ideas, and to use accessible media that people have seen before, or that it's not a silent film from Germany that goes for 4 hours. It's something that's on Netflix.
Yeah, absolutely.
Having that art form that you can view and then talk about and then go back and read about, I think that's really important, particularly for younger people to see, so that they don't get to, you know, their 30s, I was like mid-30s before I was able to kind of get to this point. I really, really want people, young people who have endo or mental illness, to be saved from the sorts of experiences that both Jacinta and I have had, of a lifetime of kind of fighting for ourselves, of having to advocate for ourselves. And I think that's the power of disability activism.
Thank you. Yeah. Jacinta, do you have anything you want to add to that on why you think representation matters?
I think Kylie said it beautifully, and I'm in just full agreement about how even owning your identity is a really complex journey. I'm going to say it too, Kylie. I'm going to say the word journey. And the more diverse stories that we see, the more nuance, the more truth, the more exposure, the more we are open with our humanity to encounter each other that way. We are just such big, broad brushstrokes, and they hurt people. So as many of these stories as we can get out there, authentically, I think it's a really important thing for us broadly and individually.
Brilliant. I think that's an excellent note to end on. Kylie Muslin, Jacinta Parsons, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. It was a wonderful conversation.
Thank you, Anthea.
This is Anthea Williams, and you're on 2RPH with Activated Arts. So, Hannah, what's on? What have you got for us this month?
I have a fairly broad view of what is art and what is an event. And sometimes we view the media around an artwork or an artist as just promotion or critique. But sometimes an interview, essay, speech, or article has such an impact or presence, it kind of sits as an event in its own right. So what I'm talking about this month is Black Blood and White Tears, Daniel Browning's interview of Fiona Hamilton on Radio National on why she's walking away from Dark Mofo and Mona in the wake of both the recent and historical treatment of herself and other First Nations artists by these organisations. It's really important listening. And bonus, you get a little taste at the end of Ronnie Gorry talking about her memoir Black and Blue, writing with PTSD, and some really insightful comments on care behaviour for readers. Mm. Audience care is something I'm recently really interested in as part of the art process. And I think Ronnie, though she is speaking from a perspective of advice to family members reading the work, I think it kind of opens up important conversation about how art and true telling are experienced. It also kind of relates to, I guess, the relational nature of art, that art isn't just the artifact of the book or the words in the book. It's what happens in that moment of in-between, in the act of reading, audiencing, viewing, or whatever way it is that we connect with that event.
That's so interesting, and it really ties into the books that we looked at this week as well. Through Kylie's book, she constantly had content warnings before each essay, and I think that's so important. But also the way she was able to look at the disabled experience framed within the media really helped me read a book that often I would have found made me focus on my pain in a way that wasn't helpful, and this really was.
The episode, Black Blood and White Tears, is on Away at Radio National, and there does not yet appear to be a transcript version online, but hopefully RN will make one available soon.
Fantastic. And what was the thing that you weren't able to see?
So this one isn't on right now, but it had a pop-up premiere at the Art Gallery of New South Wales in March and is set to announce future performance dates soon. It's called Trestle, a new ground-based work from Legs on the Wall, exploring abundance and loss. The high-profile ensemble of dancers and musicians includes the iconic Yana Castillo. Now, Yana's making tsunami-sized waves in both the mainstream and disability dance worlds and has an exquisite physical and sensorial sensitivity in her movement. This is an artist whose work you want to keep your antennae out for. I couldn't see it. I want to know where it's happening next. And is there a way it could be accessible for me and people like me to see it in the future?
Oh, that's great. Let's push Legs on the Wall for that. Absolutely. They sound like two really remarkable things to listen and or view. Thanks so much, Hannah.
Thanks for having me again this month.
I hope you enjoyed our show today. Links to all of this will be on our programs page, and we'll make sure the link to the program page is in the information about the podcast, available at all your usual outlets. See you next month.